I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about food and health. Specifically, we're going to discuss the challenges of getting healthy food to those who need it the most. My guests are John Elliott, President and CEO of Gleaners Food Bank, Emily Weichert-Bryant, Executive Director of Feeding Indiana's Hungry, and John Whitaker, Executive Director of Midwest Food Bank. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about food and health. Specifically, we're going to be talking about the challenges and opportunities of getting healthy food to those who need it the most. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are John Elliott, President and CEO of Gleaners Food Bank, Emily Weichert-Bryant, Executive Director of Feeding Indiana's Hungry, and John Whitaker, Executive Director of Midwest Food Bank. Welcome to all of you.
Good morning, John.
I hope you're all managing to stay warm on your way over here, too. It's like winter arrived with a vengeance for us today. But that probably compounds the challenge for you in some ways. I mean, is this the most hectic and busiest part of the year for people who are doing what you are trying to do? I'll start with John on that. Well, I guess I should say John Elliott, since we have an abundance of Johns on the show.
That's right. Emily is outnumbered, isn't she?
Yes.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because we've had one mobile pantry distribution today already that we had to cancel, unfortunately. So it is that season. Now, you could say in many ways the number of people who are hungry is consistent over the course of the year. Different people in line, but a similar number. This is the time of year when we have to shift focus and resources on fundraising. Mm-hmm. Is about a third of our resources come in the last 6 weeks of the year. So there's one whole part of Gleaners that's focused on that. The program side, we're having to be pretty flexible and adaptable these days as the trucks sort of slide to and from.
Emily.
Certainly. We see the same thing across the state. So full disclosure, Gleaners is one of our members mm-hmm. of our state association, and Midwest is a partner of ours through the food drop program. So we work with these folks often. We see a lot of that, particularly weather-related this time of year. I know that one of the food banks up in northern Indiana has already been closed, I think, a day in the last couple of weeks for snow. You know, logistics get to be a little more complicated for everyone this type of year. But again, the bulk of the fundraising is done this last part of the year while food banks are accommodating large influx of food donations from, you know, statewide entities like the Poultry Association donated some at the Thanksgiving holiday. We'll see pork coming from the Indiana pork producers and different things that go on this time of year, because it's most often when people associate giving food is during the holidays. When they're having meals with their families, they think of others, and that's when things really ramp up.
John.
Yeah, it's interesting you ask that question. You know, the Indie Hunger Network, which we're part of, John and I, and Emily also is consulting in that organization many times as we draw her in. Did an unmet needs study last year, and we really focused on different time of year to see what people's needs were here in Indianapolis and greater Indiana. And it clearly showed that during the winter months, people have a much more of a struggle, part of it due to transportation, part of it due to other bills and ways that they have to funnel their money. And so there is a significant increase in the need during the winter months.
I want to pick up on something John Elliott said about how a third of the resources have to come in 6 weeks. I mean, and that's, by the way, it's not applies not just to you folks. It's almost everything. The not-for-profits and jewelry stores basically have to make their nuts between Thanksgiving and New Year. That's right. So, you know, how does that affect the challenge? And, you know, one of the things that has struck me is that, you know, a thing that started out as a very helpful impulse, the idea of helping to feed the homeless on Thanksgiving or Christmas, now has become so orchestrated in many places that it literally is, you know, a volunteer stands in line, scoops one plate of food on, and then the next volunteer steps in and all of that. If people want to render meaningful service to what you are trying to do right now, what is the best and most effective? Where are the needs the greatest rather than the things that traditionally might make people feel the best? I'll start with Emily on that one.
Oh, well, John hit the nail on the head in that people are hungry year-round. And so that's, you know, we do see there are spikes of different kinds when people are experiencing shortfalls in bills and things like that. But, you know, a lot of what's happening and a lot of what's going on is just that notion of thankfulness and giving back. And mm-hmm. and in this country, it just happens to fall in the fourth quarter when retail and everyone else is busy. And so, mm-hmm. you know, we do see a lot, but for meaningful engagement, you know, my line would always be volunteer, donate, or advocate. Mm-hmm. And these guys do yeoman's jobs with volunteering and with donation and turning that into product and turning that into food. I think they could probably make a better pitch for that than I would. But I would say, you know, we're talking about hunger year-round, and we're trying to solve hunger year-round. And so it's not the sort of thing that we think of as being seasonal. It's an everyday mm-hmm. sort of thing. It's emergency relief, and every day is an emergency to someone who doesn't have food in the pantry. So how do you solve that? And there are always opportunities to engage and volunteer. And there are always opportunities to have conversations like this with people you know to talk about the nearly 1 million Hoosiers who are at risk of hunger.
And maybe I framed the question clumsily, but I guess what it is, because this is the time of year when people's impulses turn toward some sort of community engagement mm-hmm. and giving back. If they're looking for a way to do that in a way that would have an impact and actually help, you know, and we'll take it beyond the context of Thanksgiving and New Year. If you're really thinking about, okay, how could I make a difference mm-hmm. by volunteering my time, or, you know, if you're in a position writing a check, what's the best way to do that, John? Whitaker, sorry. This is going to take some getting used to, folks. Please bear with me.
You did make eye contact, though,
John.
That helps.
I did.
Yeah. Well, you know, Emily's right on. Hunger never takes a holiday, so any time a year is a good time to engage with either one of our organizations. But today at our place, you know, we have only 6 staff members, 3 full-time, 3 part-time, so we're a volunteer-driven organization. So today at our place, we have 50 people that are distributing food to agencies that come from 72 counties in our state to receive the food they need to give to the needy individuals. Where I find the most impact in someone's life is where the most difference can be made for hunger awareness is when they actually come to one of our facilities and get hands-on. Mm-hmm. And so they would be at our place, be able to come on Tuesdays and Thursdays to distribute the food to the agencies that feed the needy. We feed over 90,000 people every month in the state of Indiana through our facility. And to see the agencies come in and to hear the stories, it's very impactful. But a dollar goes a long way as well. So each one of us have really good leverage. And so we can take a dollar that someone donates that they think, you know, what will a dollar do? Well, we can leverage that sometimes up to 30-fold. And it makes a difference both ways. But I think the greatest impact in an individual to take that back home with them and share with others and to broaden their perspective on the hunger issues in our state is to come and serve.
John Elliott.
Well, not surprisingly, I find myself reinforcing my friend John's points, and I would dial it down to specifically the cash or financial contributions. Mm-hmm. We really can stretch those dollars, but equally important to leveraging and getting the most meals for those dollars that John referred to, we're in this period of transformational change where we're trying to impact both health and hunger outcomes. And by having dollars to go out and purchase disproportionately healthy food, we really can impact and deal with the reality of the clients we serve that have high diabetes rates, high heart disease rates, high obesity rates, attributable to the mix of food that they eat. They eat what they're offered and don't have the shopping options the rest of us have. So it has real health outcomes that impact them over a lifetime. So you leverage the meals per dollar, but you also leverage in a positive way health outcomes. And maybe to emphasize the transformational change, less than 2 years ago, before we launched this produce wholesale co-op that Gleaners runs for the seven Midwest states for our network, we had 0 pounds that were coming straight from the farm. Then last year, in less than 2 years, we hit 10 million pounds in a year. That is transformational change. And if you put it in percentage terms, 3.4% of total pounds out the door at Gleaners was donated surplus produce from retailers. And now we have that produce plus the straight from the farm, fresh quality produce that took us to almost a third of our pounds in less than 2 years, our produce. And that has this ripple effect through the whole network, the 600 locations across the 21 counties where Gleaners distributes food. It impacts the volunteer opportunities, the skills we need from volunteers, corporate partners, and others who would share their expertise. So we need dollars. We need expertise that we've not needed before around handling perishable food. We're on track to double the volume through our building. We won't do that without even more volunteers and more breadth and variety to the expertise they share with us. So cash dollars to buy healthy food and leverage resources and drive health outcomes also, and broadening, growing variety of volunteer experiences.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the challenges of getting healthy food to the people who need it the most. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a caller who didn't want to go on the air has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. This caller wanted to know what is going on with the food that they're getting as a result of the tariffs, the trade wars. That is in surplus and rotting. I'll start. I've picked on John Elliott first and Emily first. I'll go with John Whitaker first on that one. Are you getting any food as a result of that?
We're not getting that food at our location. I'm not sure about John.
You are John Elliott?
Yeah, okay. If you don't mind, I'll bail John out here on this one.
Okay.
There's an existing structure that's part of the USDA budget cycle every year, and so they're layering on top of that. And the Feeding America network of 200 food banks, including us, has a percent allocation of those distributions. So these tariff-relieving purchases from farmers and food businesses are going out through Feeding America food banks at a predetermined percent and rate. Gleaners is helping maybe disproportionately, as we have the larger centrally located warehouse for Indiana. Mm-hmm. So we are helping our sister food banks a little bit with distribution and so on. It's also had a nice secondary effect, or will, as it starts rolling out, where we will piggyback on the trucks that are going out with that produce, with some protein that we're getting, with some milk from Walmart and from others. All of a sudden, we can reduce overall freight costs by combining loads, and we're all out to save every penny we can.
Obviously, there was news yesterday that GM plans to cut jobs in the Midwest, and we're hearing anecdotal evidence of economic impacts from the tariffs and the trade wars. That China was somewhat savvy about this. They decided to target Trump states and come after places in the Midwest. Does that add to the workload that you and your organization say? I'm going to go with Emily because she nodded first, but I also see John Whitaker nodding too.
It certainly will. Our network is designed, and a couple of our food banks here in Indiana were created as a response to large industry closures in their community. So I know Community Harvest in Fort Wayne was very much in response 20 or 30 years ago to what was going on there. We seek to serve folks who are experiencing that emergency, that, you know, that sudden loss of employment, that's going to make things harder for them to navigate for a while. And so, you know, being able to access pantries, being able to access the SNAP program if they're eligible for the food stamps program and other things that enable them to get what they need for that short period of time would, particularly in those regional areas where those closures are occurring, be an impact on the hunger relief system.
John, I'm going to give you just a few seconds here. Before.
Yeah, you know, well, hunger's a moving target, John. Whether it's the opiate epidemic in our state or it's layoffs, anytime someone has a life-altering event, or they lose a job, their health, those all attribute to people that are making the lines longer at our pantries, and those lines are getting longer.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the challenges of getting good, healthy food to the people who need it the most. My guests are John Elliott, President and CEO of Gleaners Food Bank, Emily Weichert-Bryant, Executive Director of Feeding Indiana's Hungry, and John Whitaker, Executive Director of Midwest Food Bank. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about ways that we can get good, healthy food to people who are hungry. My guests are John Elliott, president and CEO of Gleaners Food Bank, Emily Weichert-Bryant, executive director of Feeding Indiana's Hungry, and John Whitaker, executive director of Midwest Food Bank. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So I, just before we went to the break, you know, we talked a little bit about, and I cited the, you know, the news from GM about the layoffs and all of that. There are some signals that obviously that we may be looking at a market correction right now, which has, you know, economic implications and real life implications for lots and lots of people. And what I heard all of you saying before this is, you're throwing massive amounts of work and resources at trying to meet this problem, and you know, at some level you feel like you're barely hanging on, that it's not something you can get ahead of. So I'm going to ask first, you know, what the scope of your resources, what your budgets are like, and all of that, and then a secondary question would be, you know, how much more would it take to solve the problem, to deal with the challenge, you know, that your organization has set for itself. I'll start with John Whitaker on that one.
Well, John, our budget's currently $800,000, and we'll distribute $30 million worth of food on an $800,000 budget. So if you're a mathematician, you do that math, it's about 35-to-1 leverage. And that food goes out to over 90,000 people a month in 72 counties in the state of Indiana. And we'd love to double what we do, but it takes dollars to do that. It takes space. It takes a lot of commitment from the community. It takes all of us together to do it. I always like to say that the solution to hunger in America is if everyone would care and feed their neighbor, we'd all be in greater shape. And that's very true, but people like to plug in ways that they can and use people that have the gifts and abilities to do that work in the structure that's already set. And so we do a pretty big job of feeding people, but all of us together don't do what the federal government does.
So let me just ask, though, since you say, and there's this factor of multiplier, if you've got an $800,000 budget and you wanted to double it, would that mean then, and you got to $1.6 million, would that mean that you were able to feed 180,000 people a month, or would it mean more than that?
Yeah, that's about what it would mean. I think we could really, really make a bigger impact, you know. And you think, you know, doubling a budget of $800,000, you think, wow, that should be certainly attainable. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we all struggle with the funding and fundraising in our community. And I think that's not because people aren't giving. I think it's because they haven't been educated on what the need is. And we try to do our best to have common messaging and to always be together on this, and we fight really hard to get out there and communicate to people what these people look like. And the face of hunger is just like what your neighbor looks like. It's someone that's fallen on a hard time. And I don't know about you, but no, as a kid growing up, John, I didn't worry about what was on my plate in the morning for breakfast
or lunch.
Other
than rare circumstances, no. You know, it felt relatively rare. I mean, when family went through some job loss or something like that. But, yeah, I know it. I certainly had much more security than most people did. John Elliott, your budget how much more would it take to solve to meet the challenges that you've set for your organization?
So we are part of the Feeding America Network, and I mention that because there are set conversions for those things. So our cash budget's about $10 million, and then the monetized food is another $58 million. So the way we convert, it ends up at a $68 million a year budget. Mm-hmm. We also do that with about 75 employees and over 33,000 volunteer visits last year. So there's 50 staff positions worth of value in that converted volunteerism, which is very, very helpful in terms of resources. If you take the 30-some million pounds of food that we distributed across our 21 counties, the traditional food bank role, even with a 15% increase in meal count from 17 to 18, we still hit 39% of the Feeding America meal gap for our counties, which means in theory, to meet the need, Gleaners would have to be 2.5 times our current size just to be even with the line that is out there today. And I bring it up that way also to say we're in the midst of the most ambitious strategic planning exercise Gleaners has ever undertaken, because we're not just focused on this whole nutritious way of feeding the line, a different focus in the way we proactively do that. There's an equal effort now on collaborating with many organizations, not just our traditional hunger partners, but many other organizations to reduce the line. Mm-hmm. And if we can really reduce the line, that's another way to close the gap. While we're feeding more people more effectively at a lower per meal cost, if the line shrinks also, we attain that goal faster.
Emily.
So we operate on a shoestring budget, but our purpose is slightly different than the two food banks. Our operations are just over $100,000, and that doesn't count either food donations or gifts of funds that come in that go back directly out to our members. And so we're a conduit. Often if a donor wants to make a statewide donation, have a statewide presence, for them to be able to do that within our membership. The bulk of what we do, and we is the royal we, it is me, is to bring together public resources, private resources, and collaboration. So we help the state with the programs that they administer. We work with the federal government. We talk to our elected officials about not just those programs, but the root causes of hunger. Where is this coming from? And the anti-hunger programs, so that we can help them be more efficient and effective in what they're doing and making sure that folks are getting the resources they need.
So I'm going to give Emily first crack at this, but because of all of this, but the way I set the question up was, what could you do if you got more? Give you a chance. Put the URL out there. If somebody's listening and they want to help your organization do what it's doing, how should they go about doing that?
There are two places that I would send them. First is, you can go to our website and sign up to be an advocate with us.
Okay.
It's feedingindianashungry.org, and you click on the advocate button or how to be helpful. We need people who are talking to their local council folks, their state representatives, their members of Congress, people who are in positions to make decisions about the programs and the services that our clients need to fulfill themselves. And so you can sign up to do that. We also, of course, can use funding to turn around a better outcome for what we're doing, put more resources into what we're doing, put more time and energy into what we're able to do for not just our member food banks and the 1,800 pantries that they serve, but also for the nearly 1 million Hoosiers who are at risk of hunger. So you can donate at our page as well.
And there's a donate button.
There absolutely is, yes.
John Whitaker.
Great question, John.
Well,
I could say this enough, but we appreciate being on the show. And people can, if you want to support what we do at Midwest, you can go to midwestfoodbank.org and go on our homepage and hit the link there. And there's a donate button right at the top. You can also donate to the Giving Tuesday program, trying to raise $150,000 to distribute 1 million meals in central Indiana and all the areas that we have food bank locations, as well as internationally in Haiti and East Africa. So that'd be a good place to go.
John Elliott.
Yeah, and thanks for lobbing the promo opportunity. I was going to have to figure out how to insert it myself if you didn't. So two things. One, you can certainly text to give to Gleaners. So text the word give and then the dollar amount to 317-593-2400. Or we actually have a match going on in Facebook now as well, or gleaners.org/donate. Oak Motors is going to match the first 2,100 backpacks to feed children over the weekend who don't have food otherwise. The goal for the day is 7,500 backpacks for school kids who are hungry.
And I assume that everyone here is a 501c3, so
yeah.
Every dollar that people give is tax deductible, correct?
Correct.
We are talking about how we get healthy food and deal with problems of hunger to people who are hungry. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at wfyi. Or do what a listener named Robbie has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Robbie, you're on the air.
Hi, John, regular. I was happy to really hear your program. Now, I have two questions here. The first question being, I would like to engage the schools of Indiana State, to rather the seniors as well as juniors, to get involved in this program, be it a volunteer or kind of a community services for them as well. And the other thing is, I want the students to learn from this one, because once they go there, they would understand how the importance of food is and the shortage of food is. And thereby, they can learn those lessons into their lives, because I see there is a lot of wastage that is happening in the community schools, right from the middle or even the high school, so across the board. So when I really walk into any pantries, for that matter, in any schools, public schools, I see a lot of wastage that is seen across the board. So I would like to really have this one when the kids go there, they learn from them, and then they really put their life in their role and optimize their usage of resources. What is your opinion, John?
Thanks very much for the call, Robbie, and I'll see if I can get you an answer. John Elliott.
Well, actually, Robbie, I'm glad you said that, and I agree with all aspects of your opinion. But I would tell you, too, that there's more going on than you might realize in terms of student volunteerism and activity. Of those 33,000 volunteers or so a year at Gleaners that we see, let alone those out at mobile pantry distributions or activity that happens outside our building, a significant percent are students all the way from elementary up through college. There are organized volunteer days at food banks across the state that happen. And also, you may not realize some of the national Greek organizations, fraternities and sororities that are locally based, as well as those that have their national meetings here in the city, make it a regular part of their volunteerism. The other piece you may not have thought of, but I think about the same way, is not learning through school about volunteer activities, but we actually have family volunteer nights at Gleaners as well, where parents or grandparents bring their children and volunteer side by side. And so the best scenario is where students learn it both through the school volunteer activity and through their own family or home environment. It reinforces the lesson. But I agree with you. And then also, in the last few years, Gleaners has gone from zero to now 55 school-based pantries where those are in schools. And in some cases, they're combined or coordinated with school gardens or other activities. But regardless, those pantries being on site also become learning vehicles, not just about hunger, but volunteerism. Even our newest pantry that we opened in an Ivy Tech campus in Noblesville, for the primary purpose, really, of keeping Ivy Tech and Goodwill Charter School students in class all the way to graduation so they can improve their employment and get out of the food line, so to speak. Even that one's had that effect, because we've seen faculty and students of Ivy Tech and Goodwill Excel Center volunteering in the Gleaners pantry, feeding their fellow students so those students stay in class in their classrooms and graduate.
Emily, how much of this, because you've talked about you know, educating people about the causes of hunger. And I think John Whitaker alluded to the face of hunger being no different. You know, how much how important are these sort of educational efforts? Because, you know, as is the case with, I think, so many American problems, part of the challenge in dealing with it is that we always think that it's something that happens to other people, that it, you know, that it can't touch us or our lives, when in fact, if you look at the numbers, it does. It lands fairly close. It will hit people that we know. How important is it to start educating people about that reality?
I think it's vitally important because, you know, we're talking about the general public who has the opportunity to weigh in on public policies that's being made, but also to be able to contribute to the solution. We've seen a growth, I think, and an enhanced awareness about hunger in this country, at least in the nearly 10 years that I've been doing this. I think it's been discussed a lot more, but I think there's still a lack of understanding that, you know, domestic hunger looks like our friends and neighbors. It doesn't look like international hunger. But I've seen a lot of opportunities that have come forth, particularly with students and with younger people, that have made them more aware and provide them the opportunity to share that experience with their parents. I know that several years back, Feeding America partnered with Sesame Street, and there was a family who visited a pantry. And there's loads of curriculum that goes around that to be able to have that conversation with your child. I've seen school food drives just within my own household and my kids. There's the food rescue program that operates in a number of schools that picks up the unopened items. And I think getting that information and that perspective to kids at a very early stage is only helpful in promoting the overall awareness, because those kids are going to come home and talk about it. You know, maybe it's something that comes up at holidays. Maybe it's something that they talk about as a family. And it certainly resonates and enhances the conversation that we have in the public space about hunger and what that means in our communities.
John Whitaker, how much of this is also, there's no other way to get around it, so I'm going to ask it plainly. There's a stigma associated with poverty and with hunger that prevents a lot of people from coming forward and actually acknowledging that they're hungry. How big a challenge does that make your work in actually trying to dealing with that?
It's a huge challenge, you know, not just going to a pantry, but signing up for SNAP and doing things that people, you know, really struggle with, really predominant in the rural areas of our state, where there are smaller communities where everyone knows everyone. I was in Rochester, Indiana, at a pantry, Matthews Market, and while we were doing a documentary film up there for promotional thing for the food bank, a single mom came up with five children in her car, got out of her car, and I was at the back while they were shooting the piece up front. She says, I need some food. And I said, well, we can help you. She goes, I said, the front door's right over. She says, I don't want to go in the front door. I don't want anyone to see me. Can you just go in and get me some food and bring it back out to my car? And that really hit home with me.
What do you do in a situation like that, Joe?
Well, we went in there and we got her food and we took it to her car, and we told her how she could receive help, and that it wasn't anything about her. She was just in a situation, and she was just like anyone else that had fallen on hard times and she needed help. We don't put people down to lift them up, and that's the beautiful thing about all the food banks and the work that we do. We're reaching out to people just like us. And so, yeah, it's hard. It's hard to get people to come forward. That's why people need advocates. You know, we have a lot of people in rural areas that have to send someone else to the pantry for them because they don't have transportation. So they have an advocate to do that for them. And that's part of building a better community, I think, John. We need to just really be better neighbors.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about ways we can get good, healthy food to people who are hungry and need it the most. My guests are John Elliott, President and CEO of Gleaners Food Bank, Emily Weichert-Bryant, Executive Director of Feeding Indiana's Hungry, and John Whitaker, Executive Director of Midwest Food Bank. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the ways that we can get and the challenges of getting good, healthy food to people who are hungry. My guests are John Elliott, president and CEO of Gleaners Food Bank, Emily Weichert Bryant, executive director of Feeding Indiana's Hungry, and John Whitaker, executive director of Midwest Food Bank. We've talked about, you know, in some ways the worries about, you know, the changes in employment. We talked about the tariffs, the possibility of a coming economic correction. How closely do you folks have to monitor things like that to make decisions? And what do you think it will do to your workload if, you know, we haven't seen the full impact of the tariffs yet, one way or the other. And certainly if there's a correction of, you know, as some economists are predicting, 10 to 15%, that would have a significant impact as well. John Whitaker, you made the mistake of making eye contact and nodding at me, so I'm going to go with you first on that one. But I want to hear everyone's thoughts.
Well, it's a great impact. It's a great question because we're what you might call, John, the safety net. Mm-hmm. For the feeding in America. We catch some of the loose ends, you might say, people that fall through the cracks. And we also support and supplement what people don't get when they go and sign up for SNAP, because SNAP is a supplemental nutritional assistance program. It's not meant to give them the entire needs, fulfill the entire need that they have as far as meals and nutrition. So that's a really good question, and one that I think about often is what would it look like in a world where entitlement programs are cut and people are out of work, and a lot of the monetary value that people have to put back into the system as far as benevolence mm-hmm. is drawn back. It's not pretty. That's why we need to be working really hard to build back up the network and to have these kind of programs to let people know that you can make a difference and we all need to work together in this. And so that's why we do things like urban gardens, and we get people involved in hunger advocacy, and we let people see what hunger looks like and what the great need is, and that it can't be just the government. It can't just be public and private sector. It can't be just faith-based. It's got to be all of us. Because really, John, our goal is right to work ourselves out of a job, right? Mm-hmm. Our goal is that one day hunger would be something of the past, where everyone would be fed and cared for. And I know that's utopia, but that's really what our goal is. Our goal is to end hunger one day and to be able to do that in a really effective way, and it's going to take all of us.
John Elliott.
You know, I think John's certainly on the right track, and I think if you draw a distinction between food insecurity and hunger, it's mm-hmm. attainable. You know, there will always be people who, for one reason or another, there's a trigger event in their lives, whether it's health or unemployment or something, they're food insecure. The key and the goal we truly can't aspire to is to dealing with the hunger or avoiding the hunger that results from that, so that there's an effective network of resources and opportunities for them to be fed and, frankly, fed well with healthy, nutritious food. I think we can aspire to that. We'll never eliminate the causes or trigger events that lead to hunger. But advocacy, John and Emily brought up too, and I really would say our role is not to engage in politics as hunger relief leaders. Our role really is to educate and advocate differently in some ways mm-hmm. with consistent messages at the federal, the state, and the local level. At the local level, whether that's township trustees or mayors or others, we need them as sleeves rolled up, hands-on partners, county by county or community by community, part of the solution. The state leaders, it's differently. You know, it's supporting the state agencies who to equip them to be the most effective partners we can. Great partners like State Department of Health and FSSA and Jim McClellan with the opioid crisis and others that are all in our interconnected space. The federal side is more complicated and scary, and if you're okay, I'll tee up Emily. But our reality is that every time the farm bill is up for review, we hold our breath and nearly pass out with anxiety because those four federal programs are 82% of the meals in the Gleaner service area. And we can talk about 30 million meals plus from Gleaners in a year, but that's 8% of the meals needed. SNAP and WIC and TFAP and the school lunch program are 82% of the meals, or more than 10 times everything Gleaners does. So we've got to get to the point where we advocate solutions that reduce the line and reduce the frightening dependency on those federal programs.
Emily, you've been teed up officially.
I have. John's great at that. Yeah, we've been looking at a lot of preemptive advocacy. You know, we spend a lot of time talking to policymakers and to the public about what the federal nutrition programs do that John had mentioned and how they are effective or what would make them more effective. We're always looking for better solutions to be able to get food to people who need it through those different programs. We've seen in the past policies that or legislative proposals that seek to restrict access through different ways. And so we try to explain, you know, if you limit a state's ability to open up some programs or to open up some waivers so that if you have an economic readjustment, if you have high unemployment, you know, those programs are designed to meet that need. The SNAP program particularly, when, you know, we saw a large increase in people participating after the 2009 economic situation. It's slowly going back down. We want to make sure that when, because it's always a when, you know, when the economy is going to turn south for a little while, we want to make sure that folks can access that program and it hasn't been restricted to the point where they can't. We spend a lot of time talking about the Farm Bill. A lot of time. I think I've been to Washington six times this year, and I think I'm done for the year. But, you know, having the certainty, not just for the ag community, which is a huge deal for them, but knowing what we can expect in those federal nutrition programs going forward is important. So, you know, we're still watching with bated breath. At this point, we're reading tweets coming out of the press corps at Congress as to where we think the Farm Bill is, which is less than settling. But it's, you know, it's something that they're still working on that we really hope that we'll get a good farm bill so that we know when the economy takes a turn what we have to work with.
Do you think that that people are aware of how close to the precipice they walk? I mean, you know, anytime you you look at the numbers in even in urban areas, I know John alluded to the problem in rural areas where everybody knows everyone, but you know, with a lot of the new acronyms they use, they establish pretty clearly that in some places between 40% and 50% of the population is either you know, living in poverty and you know, experiencing hunger, or is one missed paycheck, one serious illness, one really bad car repair away from being in real financial and in some cases food distress. Do you think that they're aware of that, that as many people live that close to danger and being in this situation, John Elliott?
You know, I think there are two aspects to your question. You could answer it from the perspective of people aware of how much their neighbors are in need, and certainly they are not aware.
But sometimes it's not your neighbor, it's you.
Well, right, and that's the other way that you could answer it, is
or could be
people
you.
Know their own situation that closely. So I'd emphasize a couple of things. One is the interconnected nature of poverty. You know, whether the event that leads to food insecurity, you know, is health or employment or what. What we've been really working hard at Gleaners and with other partnerships is trying to change the dialogue in this community and stop jumping from one single topic to another in terms of our attention and our resources. We pile on pre-K. We pile on mass transit. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, the families that we all three support are dealing with this interconnected mix of challenges. So we need as a community to solve all of those poverty issues at the same time. And I think people may be aware that they have a financial problem or a health problem or an unemployment problem, but I think they don't sit down and think about those interconnected issues themselves, let alone have neighbors or others with resources sit down and think about the interconnected problem. So that's the main thing. Interconnected challenges of poverty have to be tackled simultaneously, solved simultaneously through partnerships, not through Gleaners or others growing our mission or our scope, but partnerships.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the challenges of getting good, healthy food to people who need it the most. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Brittany has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Brittany, what's on your mind?
Thank you so much, all of you, for putting this show on today and participating in this. And it's so helpful to so many. I feel very heartened listening to it. So thank you so much for doing this today. I love what you were talking about when you're talking about interconnected challenges facing people who have food insecurity. And as my husband and I do live in food insecure areas and food deserts, the interconnected issues between, well, there's just so many, but in the instance I was thinking of when I called today, we have a church nearby that does great work in the neighborhood but had to make the choice between closing down the food kitchen, which they ended up doing, in order to offer childcare for people in the neighborhood. And I just see this, it's just exacerbated the food insecurity in our area to a great degree. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've even had neighbors come up and knock on my door and ask for food. You know, it's pretty prevalent in that area to begin with. And now with this program, this food program being ended in the neighborhood, it's just caused even more of a difficulty for people. So neighbors got together and put out a blessing box in our neighborhood. And I just thought it was such a great way to kind of give people the accessibility without, you know, without the judgment. They can access the box all hours of the day and night. There's a secondary box that offers other kinds of personal products. And also, I'm sure we'll continue to offer, like, cold weather items as the season continues to get colder outside. Just wondered what your thoughts were on that kind of easy, accessible, you know, gift boxes or giving boxes, I guess, blessing boxes, as they're called, in neighborhoods that people themselves can easily contribute to.
Thank you so much. Thanks very much for the call and for sharing that, Brittany. Emily, I'll start with you.
I'm always amazed anywhere that I go and when I talk to folks in small communities particularly, there's always somebody doing something for a neighbor. And I don't think that, you know, Indianapolis is any exception to that. There's always ways to try to make it as seamless or as one-stop shop for folks who are in need and have these interconnected challenges. One of the things that I would put out there as a plug is if people are eligible utilizing the SNAP program, they're shopping at the grocery store like everyone else. They have a different card and a different payment mechanism. But if you've been through the grocery store where you push the button and your choices are credit, debit, EBT, gift card, all those other things, it's the same thing everyone else is doing. And so being able to utilize that program not only provides them access to food in, you know, a fairly judgment-free zone or what should be a judgment-free zone, is also going to free up other resources for that family to pay that utility bill, to try to find childcare, transportation and other costs. It's offsetting some of their food budget and providing other options to them. It's something that's not noticeable. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of ways for folks to access help that shouldn't stigmatize them, and nor should they feel stigmatized. This happens to a large chunk of our population at some point in their lives. And so, there's lots that can be done in communities, small efforts, larger efforts, or, you know, maybe working together to find a nonprofit nearby. If this is in Indianapolis, there's going to be a pantry somewhere closer to there where that that soup kitchen or that food facility was, that maybe they work with them to staff up with more volunteer hours, encourage them to be open longer periods, helping with rides to the pantries and other things, because there will be a resource available close to them in that community. And if they're not sure where it is, they can always call 211 for help.
I'll ask the uncomfortable question here. I mean, obviously the impulse here is entirely laudable. You know, they want to help, but at least part of what I think your organizations bring to the table is that it's not just that you're providing food. It's supposed to be healthy food. It's also supposed to be safe food, that there are guarantees there that if someone eats this, they're not likely to get sick. Not that anyone would deliberately do that with this effort, but it creates that presence of mind. John Whitaker?
Yeah, that's exactly where mine was going to. How do you shove a healthy head of lettuce into that box and make sure it's consumable? Or what other items do they have and need? But I tell you what, it's really commendable that neighbors are helping neighbors. And that's I applaud you, Brittany, for the work you're doing in your community. But I would also ask you to take another step. Is there a group of people in your community that could get together and could do something about what happened to the church and start something in a pantry in a home, a pantry in or come to the realization that maybe you can't do it in your community, but there's a place close by you can help. And then John and I at the food banks, we can try to intervene and get the food you need. John's got mobile pantries. We have one-off things that we can do. And we, you know, it just hurts me when I hear these things, because I know that, you know, as hard as we work, we still have just scratched the surface of what the need is. And so thank you for trying to take care of that.
Well, let me ask this then. Suppose it is someone in Brittany's situation where, you know, what was a valued community resource? And it sounds like that church had a really tough call to make, which is, do we provide child care so that the people in the neighborhood can go work and earn a living and you know, build a future for their families, or do we feed them in the short term? That's a true Faustian bargain. If there is a neighbor or a set of neighbors there who would be willing to set up, you know, meet your challenge right now and say, yeah, we'll try to set up a pantry in one of our homes or do something like that. How should they go about doing that? Who should they call? John?
Well, yeah. There's more than one person back at Gleaners holding their breath to see if I make a commitment about a new food pantry. So my Gleaners colleagues can exhale. I'm not headed down that path. But the point is really that there's a need for a variety, you know, large-scale wholesale distribution like Gleaners does, but also neighborhood-centric efforts like mobiles and so on, but even a neighborhood garden. As long as we have a meal gap in this state of 170 million meals a year, I don't really care whether it's two meals at a time or 20,000 meals at a time. It all needs to add up to erasing that 170 million meal gap.
That'll have to be the last word, but I'm going to ask the three of you to do something. I asked you earlier to give you URLs and ways people could contribute. I'm going to ask you to go to our Facebook page where our listeners often continue the conversation. Put that information there so that they can just click real quickly and go. I'd like to thank my guests, John Elliott, Emily Weichert-Bryant, and John Whitaker, for what has been an important conversation. Thank our listeners, as always, for bringing such great questions to the table. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting station.